interview today. Can you just tell people who you are and what Care Oklahoma is, just to get us started?
Sure. My name is Adam Sultani. I'm the executive director of Care Oklahoma. And CAIR, spelled C-A-I-R, stands for the Council on American Islamic Relations. We are the Oklahoma chapter. We're actually one of 35 chapters here in the United States. Our national office was founded in 1994 in Washington, D.C. And what a lot of people don't realize, there's a lot of history in Oklahoma regarding our national office. They actually flew out here in 1995 to defend the Muslim community and the Arab community, who, as many people may remember, when the Murrah bombing took place, for 48 hours, Muslims and Arabs were the prime suspect in that. So our national office actually flew out here in 95 and defended the Muslim community. So there's a long history of CAIR in Oklahoma, and this chapter is about 11 years old.
So can you just explain some of the numerous things you all do to help out the community?
Yeah, sure. So we were founded originally as a civil rights organization, and that's really our meat and potatoes, if you will. That's the core of the work we do. And in the process of, you know, being around for more than 20 years, and this chapter being around for more than 11 years, there's been a variety of other things we've had to do. Of course, enhancing the understanding of Islam is a big one, because there's a big misunderstanding, especially with the 24-hour news cycle and all the hate rhetoric we see coming out of the Islamophobic atmosphere, if you will, that exists in America these days. So enhancing the understanding of Islam, protecting the rights of Muslims, providing them a place that they can go when they have legal questions or concerns about legal issues, empowering the Muslim community. So we do youth leadership programs. We've actually done a Muslim youth leadership symposium every summer for the last 8 years. We also empower our community by getting them connected to other community organizations and grassroots volunteer efforts. So we have an annual day of service every year during the month of Ramadan, when we're fasting from sunup to sundown, no food or drink, and we go to the Regional Food Bank of Oklahoma and we package food for our fellow Oklahomans in need. And we actually packaged 21,000 pounds, enough food that is equivalent to 21,000 meals for Oklahomans this past summer, which is really neat. So that's how we empower our community. And last but not least, we also started a government affairs department, because we see a lot of anti-Muslim rhetoric coming from the political scene, coming from our own state capital, coming from on the national level. So we saw it very important to do three things: educate our community about the issues that should be important to them, provide them with opportunities to engage with their elected officials, and last but not least, empower them so they can advocate on behalf of themselves, their family, and their community at the end of the day.
So that was a lot. There's so many great things to unpack with that.
Yeah.
You just start on those three things. Like, how do you educate your community?
Yeah. Are you talking about educating the Muslim community or the external community outside the Muslim community?
Both.
Okay. Well, let's talk about our Muslim community. So within the Muslim community, we have to educate them on their rights. That's a huge issue, because a lot of times people's rights are violated and it's because they don't know what their rights are. You know, we have had countless people call our office, say, oh, the FBI showed up at my door and I invited them in for tea. Like, you don't have to invite them in for tea. In fact, you shouldn't invite them in for tea. And you have the right to have an attorney present before you speak with law enforcement officials. So that's one example of an area where we work to educate our community. So we offer Know Your Rights seminars, we have Know Your Rights pamphlets and brochures and information on our website and our social media. We do the live Facebook videos. We do everything we can to make sure our community has the information they need to assert their rights as Oklahoma citizens, as American citizens. So educating our community on civil rights issues, educating our community on issues related to their local and national government. How can they voice their concerns to their representative or senator? What happens if their senator or representative says something that's against the Muslim community? You know, what can they do? So educating our community in this way. Also educating them about what Islamophobia is and how they can work to challenge it. Things as simple as building relationships with their neighbors, their coworkers, their colleagues, inviting them out for lunch or dinner. So that's the internal education that we do. We also have an educational outreach department where we try to reach out beyond the Muslim community. And one, we try to educate people about generally what Islam and Muslims are all about, because there's a lot of misunderstanding in the world today. I mean, that's just unfortunately the way it is. So we've done a lot of educational campaigns. We have distributed the Holy Quran, the holy book of the Muslim community for free, just so people can read it, because our scripture is oftentimes taken out of context and people try to misquote it. So we tell people, look, we'll give you a free copy. Read it for yourself. Don't listen to what other people have to say. We've also distributed back in 2012, you remember the Benghazi incident, and in which the embassy was burned and the ambassador to I believe it was Libya, is it? Or no, wherever Benghazi is, I forgot, was killed, you know. And when that happened, the reason that unfortunate incident happened in the first place, and there were protests around the world, was that a very hateful video went up on YouTube that was basically slandering the Prophet Muhammad, the prophet of the Muslim religion, of the Islamic faith. And that was why people reacted, unfortunately, in a very negative way. That does not justify their actions. But what we realize is that people don't know enough about the life of the Prophet Muhammad. So we purchased thousands of copies of this DVD called Legacy of a Prophet, which is a PBS documentary, has won many awards, and we distribute thousands of copies for free to people all around the state of Oklahoma. We also go to universities, synagogues, churches, all different places, high schools, middle schools, anywhere people want to invite us to speak about Islam and answer questions, we do that, you know. And then, of course, we have a huge social media presence. And I think nowadays social media is perhaps even stronger than traditional television or print media. And so we try to be very intentional about the information we put on social media, and we try to use it not only to spread awareness about the work of CARE, but also to spread awareness about the Islamic faith and who are Muslims in Oklahoma.
So this keeps coming back to misunderstanding. Mm-hmm. And we actually did an episode a long time ago about Islamophobia. It was one of our first episodes we did.
Okay.
Most people know basically nothing about it. Like, how do you fight that misunderstanding? Because when most people think of Muslim or Islam, all they think about is just terrorists.
Yeah, yeah. So how do you get through to people that don't know anything about?
All they hear is like bad stuff about it.
That's tough. And I think that's the biggest challenge in places like Oklahoma. So when you look at Oklahoma as a state, you've only got two major metropolitan areas. You've got the Tulsa metropolitan area and the Oklahoma City metropolitan area. The vast majority of our state is rural, and I can never say that word, rural, you know, outside of the metros. And Muslims just do not live in those places. You don't have Muslims living in Ponca City or McAllister, or actually we do have some Muslims living in Ada, but there are only a handful, you know. But you just don't have them in these smaller cities, which are most of our state. And so Pew Research Center, they did a research study a few years ago, and they found that the best way for people to dispel their myths and misunderstandings about Islam and Muslims is to get to know someone. So a person is twice as likely to look favorably upon Islam and Muslims if they know somebody. So that means that it's really a huge burden on the Muslim community, not just the CARE organization, but on the community in general. And there's only about 40,000 Muslims in the state. So at best, we're 1% of the total population. So that means we really have got to get out there and know as many people as possible and just try to talk to them and invite them for dinner, invite them for lunch. I mean, I've taken my neighbors out to dinner, and we have a lot of amazing restaurants that serve, you know, kebabs and hummus and all these wonderful Mediterranean or Indian, Indo-Pak cuisines, and they love the food, you know, and that kind of sparks conversation. So finding a way to build a bridge between you and other people, and then using that to kind of create awareness. So it's one person at a time. There's no easy way to change this, you know, atmosphere of misunderstanding.
That just seems incredibly unfair if you're a person of like Islam or Muslim faith, because you have to go out in the community that's in a lot of ways talking down on you, persecuting you, like you just said, violating your civil rights, and you have to get to know them and be kind.
Yeah,
that does not sound fun for anyone, especially if you're younger. Like, I can't imagine being like 15 and you're like, oh, I don't celebrate Christmas, and the kids in the class is what they would say.
Yeah, like, why not? Why not? That's not cool. No, I went through the same thing, you know. I mean, when I was young, I was really shy, you know, about I didn't have a strong understanding of my own identity, and I think nowadays younger Muslims are a lot better than that, than I was, because we do have organizations that work to empower them and educate them. And I think the challenge is on two groups of people. You have the challenge is on the Muslim community. So we do have a burden on our shoulders. It is unfair, but it is just the reality of being Muslim in America these days. So we have to accept that as a challenge and an opportunity to really get out there and get to know people. So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect is, I think there's a burden on people who do have an understanding that Islam is a religious faith. It is one of the Abrahamic traditions, along with Christianity and Judaism. And those people that see that there's nothing wrong with accepting the Muslim population as part of the fabric of America, which truly Muslims are. We've been here since the 1700s. Actually, Muslims were brought over on slave ships. You know, it's not like Muslims immigrated to this land first. Really, Muslims were brought to this land, approximately 10 to 15 million Muslims were brought over on slave ships, along with, I mean, I'm sorry, 2 to 3 million of the 10 to 15 million that were originally brought. That being said, I think those that who are not Muslim but do have an understanding, they also have a burden on their shoulders to help enhance the understanding of the faith and to speak up when they hear negative rhetoric. So if you're not Muslim and you're sitting amongst a group of people and they start, you know, saying hateful things about Muslims, I really think you should stand up, speak up, and not be afraid to let them know that, hey, that's wrong. We can't allow hate rhetoric to exist in our society and go unchecked.
I think, like, so I'm one of those people that agree with you, you should speak up. The problem with that is, like, the counter to that argument is, like, hey, I worked hard for this job. If I speak up, I might get fired. And the counter to that argument is, hey, can you imagine being the person of Islam that's being talked bad about every single day?
Right. It's
just a bad situation all around.
It is, and you have to have courage. You have to be brave. I mean, being courageous doesn't always mean you get to live a comfortable life, you know. Being brave doesn't mean that you may not lose your position at work, or you may not lose friends, but you have to decide if you want to stand up for what's right, or you want to stand up for, or you just kind of want to let your values be pushed to the side by people who want to promote hatred and bigotry. So there is a right and wrong side to history, I truly believe. And these days, after what we've seen in Charlottesville last week, after what we've seen with our presidential administration putting forth a Muslim ban, you know, banning people specifically from Muslim countries, after what we've seen with the local representative, John Bennett, who I personally don't even think deserves the title of representative anymore, because all he's done for the last 4 years is spew hatred and propagate hatred against the Muslim community. And these are just a few examples. I mean, you have mosques being burned to the ground. You have people being killed. We had a Christian Lebanese man who was killed by his neighbor, who was a white man, who had previously gone to prison because he hit the Lebanese guy's, his mother, with a car, and had a history of documented hatred against his family. He went on, and his name was Khalid Jabara, he went on his front porch and shot him in the back of the head and killed him because he thought he was Muslim. So when you have all this stuff going on, there is a right side and a wrong side to history. Those who stand up for what is right and say that, no, we're a country that was founded upon the ideals of religious freedom. We're a country that was founded upon the ideals of equality and justice for all, then you're on the right side of history. But if for some reason you think that it's okay to allow hate to exist towards any group of people, you're on the wrong side.
Again, so much to unwind in that. That was a great answer. So I read a statistic before I came in here. Once every single day, a Muslim American is being discriminated against just because they're Islam.
Yeah.
Basically, like the 1960s and 1950s for African Americans is happening today for people of Islam in America. And none of us seem to like notice or care, or at least in the mainstream populace.
Mm.
That's just depressing. It's 2017. Also, yeah. You brought up politicians. Mm. I feel like with politicians, they're either one of two things.
Yeah.
They either bash the Islam community, or they only speak up for them whenever something like a terrorist attack happens.
Mm.
So it creates this cycle of one side denouncing them and the other side only defending them whenever a terrorist attack happens, instead of when there's no terrorist attack happening, saying, hey, we still need to do something to build a community. Yeah. So I feel like on both sides of the equation, you're being hurt. Right. And then there's the obvious person in office right now that's our president. How do you feel about all that? Just the politics in America, the people that represent us.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, not all politics is bad. I think that needs to be said. The problem right now is that those in politics that have unwelcome views, that have hateful views, that choose to use their power to divide rather than unite, they're the loudest. And they get the most airtime, if you will. I mean, Trump has been all over the media for a year prior to even his presidency. And still he dominates much of the media. And even here in Oklahoma, you've got a lot of amazing people at the Capitol. I know many of them personally. We established a government affairs department 6 months ago, and we have built a lot of positive relationships with both Democrats and Republicans at the Capitol. So the problem is not that there aren't good people. The challenge is, are they willing to speak up? And there are many. Representative George Young, Representative Cindy Munson, Representative Jason Dunnington, and several others. Those are just a few people who have been willing to speak up on behalf of the Muslim community, whether it be through social media or whether it be through other forms of media. However, you have people like John Bennett in our state who, whenever he says something crazy, like just happened a few days ago, it once again dominates the media. He put a post on his Facebook page and he said, if people are asking for the removal of Confederate statues, then shouldn't we remove all mosques in America post 9/11? And the comparison, I know, it doesn't even make sense. I mean, I don't even want to go into the comparison. The point is, he has never promoted the ideals of religious freedom. You know, he's actually gone against those. And in fact, I have said over and over again that he has violated his oath of office, just like probably the president is doing as well, by not upholding the constitutional rights for all people. So I think this is the challenge that we have these days when it comes to politics. Politicians promote hate rhetoric, and it does not exist within a vacuum. It has a real and negative impact on society. And what we have noticed is that every time there's a spike in anti-Muslim rhetoric from politicians or from other segments of the community, but generally from politicians, there is a similar increase in hate crimes and violence towards Muslims in America.
Do you have the paper statistics on this? I just want to put it in the description.
Yeah, no, I just have to look it up, yeah.
Send it to us, email us, yeah. We'll put it in the description, I got you.
For sure. So I think that's the big challenge nowadays, is trying to find ways to calm down the hate rhetoric. And how we're going to do that, I don't know, because for some reason, Islam and Muslims has become a political football, as has many other issues, but we're constantly in the media, and as some leaders in the American Muslim community have said, you know, we didn't try to become political, but rather people have taken our faith and politicized it. Therefore, by default, we have been dragged into the political arena, and now we are just trying to clear the misunderstanding of who we are and what our faith truly is all about.
When you say misunderstanding, to certain people, like, the reason people want the Confederate statues down is because they stood for an economic system of discrimination. They mm-hmm. were comfortable with violating people's civil rights for economic prosperity. They think the same thing about the Islam community. Like, it's just, hey, why shouldn't we just burn them all down too? And that's just massive misunderstanding.
Yeah, absolutely.
I can't even imagine how you would even begin to fight that, especially with how little people of Islam there are in the country.
Yeah, one day at a time, one step at a time. I don't think there's any easy way. But one thing that I always remind my community and I remind myself is that we have got to go back to the founding documents of this country. And the Constitution of the United States is very clear that religious freedom was enshrined for all people. Whether or not that was what was in the minds of those who authored the Constitution, that's the way it exists today. And we have got to uphold the values of the Constitution, the religious freedom, and the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, which states that government will not interfere or make laws that neither help nor hinder religion. Those are very clear. And many years ago, we had an event and we called it Upholding Our Constitution, Defending Our Faith. And I really think, in a nutshell, that defines the work of CARE. We're all about upholding the constitutional values of the United States and the state of Oklahoma, and we're about defending our faith. We're not trying to change things unless we're changing them for the better, but we're trying to uphold things as they already stand.
To bring it back, you were talking about the travel ban?
Yeah, the Muslim ban.
Yes.
Yeah.
Can you just tell the people listening or watching the facts about the statistics of Muslims in this country and those countries, and how they were violating rights with the Muslim ban?
Well, I mean, the thing is, when it was proposed, you could see very clearly, and the reason I stated that that's a Muslim ban is because the original proposal was 7 countries that Trump wanted to sign an executive order to ban travel of refugees was one, also to limit visas and maybe even would impact green card holders. U.S. citizens were pretty much safe. There were some weird wording about dual citizens and things of that nature. However, the point is, all 7 original countries, of which now is down to 6 countries, were all Muslim majority populations. There are a lot of countries in this world, if you're really concerned about terrorism or violence or whatnot, there are probably other countries in this world that should have been included on that list. But in reality, Trump was just targeting countries that he thought would probably appeal to his constituency. And on top of that, there's a whole other issue of banning refugees. I mean, we've been a country that, for what it's worth, has really been built off the back of refugees and people fleeing, you know, war-torn countries or impoverished countries and coming to America for a better life. What happened to opening our doors to people who are in need? And in particular, it just boggles my mind that the Syrian refugee population, which is the largest refugee population in the world, is completely denied any ability to come to the United States. I mean, in the first place, even under President Obama, we were still taking in a very small number of Syrian refugees compared to other countries, but Trump completely blocked that. You know, so what are we telling the world, that we're no longer the country that opens its doors to people, or we only open doors to people who we like? You know, it's a very negative message and something that I don't think anyone should be happy with.
Absolutely. Whenever you hear about refugees, all you hear about is like the one that did something bad in Europe.
If even that. Because some of those stories they say are fabricated too, so they're not all true.
Completely false.
Yeah.
And they get spread on a Twitter feed.
Exactly.
It's not fact checked.
Yeah.
But if you actually look at the statistics, like refugees, immigrants, like they're coming from whole other countries, they have no reason to commit crimes.
Yeah.
Like if you're moving, like if you moved from Oklahoma to California, your first guess whenever you get there is like, hey, I'm gonna go steal, do property crimes. No, listen, why I need to get a job and settle down. Like, that is not your first priority.
The basic necessities of life.
But they, like, it's assumed that all these refugees are just wild animals.
Well, and also it's misunderstood that there is already a very diligent process that refugees have to go through to get into the country. It's not just that they're granted a visa and say, welcome to America. No, I mean, there are already background checks and other checks that they have to go through. And on top of that, there is no documentation that will support the claim that refugees are a threat to the United States, because refugees are not the ones committing crimes. In fact, one thing that I think should be brought up now and anytime discussions like this are had is that Muslims are not really a threat to America at all. I mean, there is an FBI report that came out that from 1985 to 2005, I believe it was, 20-year period, only 4 or 6% of all acts of terrorism, as documented by the FBI, were committed by people who were Muslim or claimed to be Muslim. So that means, you know, 94 to 96%, which is a large percentage of acts of terrorism as documented by the FBI were committed by people who are not of the Islamic faith. But in the media, the proportion, it's, you know,
the opposite.
The opposite, right. But going back to the idea of refugees, there's no documentation that can back up that refugees are a threat to this country. In fact, I think the biggest threat to this country, as we have seen in recent time, but it's not talked about enough, is white supremacists. They seem to be the more violent group of people, yet they're not given the same harsh treatment that other minority groups are in the media for even lesser crimes.
Absolutely. It's like, we actually did an episode on decriminalizing immigrants and refugees.
Okay.
So, not to hype us up, but we agree with everything you just said right there.
Go watch the episode.
But, yeah, it's just this idea of if you're Islam, or if you're basically, if you're a minority in America and something bad happens, you have to represent that whole group.
Right, you're it.
Like, so you go to school, something bad happens, and you're that kid, like, you represent Islam.
Yeah.
If you're black in America, something happens, someone gets killed, Trayvon Martin, you
right.
represent that. You're white in America, and the Charlottesville thing happened, you don't have to answer for that.
Exactly.
It's just a privilege that comes with it.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, there are some very good examples here in Oklahoma, and I'll mention those real quickly. Just last week or a week and a half ago, there was the foiled FBI discovered a bomb plot. And there's a lot of crazy stuff about that. The guy wanted to blow up the bank for spilling in downtown, and there's some other things of concern about his mental state and whatnot. But the point is, his faith was never brought up in any of the media reports. I am 100% confident that had that person been Muslim, or had they been black, or had they been anything else, their ethnicity, their religion, what church or army, what mosque they go to, would have been brought up. And the example, how can I back that up, is back in 2014, we had this guy named Alton Nolan, who is a criminal by definition, he's a criminal, and he beheaded a woman at Von Foo's down in Moore, Oklahoma. And because he claimed to be Muslim, we don't even know the guy. I mean, nobody in the community even knew the guy. He converted to Islam in prison, had been out of prison for a while. By now, as several years have gone by, they've come to find out he's not even mentally competent to stand trial. But at that time, because he committed a crime and he said he was Muslim, all it took was the Moore chief of police to say that he was actively trying to convert people to Islamic faith. That was his exact words. And the local media just ran with this. Oh my God, he was Muslim. Islam had something to do with it. They want to interview, you know, the people at the mosque. They want to interview me. We even had Fox News send reporters down here and basically stalk people in the Muslim community, trying to uncover, you know, what took place to make this happen. Exactly 2 weeks later, in Stillwater, a young white guy, excuse me, a young white man, he killed his roommate over religious differences, and he was a self-proclaimed Christian zealot. So that was in his words. He beheaded his roommate over religious differences because he said his roommate was like a witch or, you know, idol worshiper or something like that. I don't remember. And that got like one article in the paper. And the Christian community was not held responsible for that. The white community was not held responsible for that. In those 2 weeks, I felt truly that something bad was going to happen. Thankfully, it didn't. You know, thankfully it didn't. But in those 2 weeks, between my office and the office of the Islamic Society of Greater Oklahoma City, which is the largest and most active mosque in the metro area, we had probably about 500 death threats and threats for people to come and commit acts of violence against us. That's scary, you know. But why does this happen to us as a community when someone commits a crime and it doesn't even go in line with our faith? That crime that person committed is the exact opposite of what our faith teaches. Just as the crime that the white person committed is not in line with the Christian teachings. Yet the Muslim community and the Islamic faith are held responsible by the public, by the media, and white Christians, not. And no one should be held responsible. I'm not saying that they should, but there's just a huge difference there, and it's got to be noted.
Yeah, death threats. That's terrifying.
Yeah.
Like, that should be talked about more often. So, you went on, basically, you're talking about defending Islam. Mm-hmm. Have you ever had, like, we try to be as transparent as possible on the positive truth. If you're wrong, have you ever had to defend it on, like, Fox News, CNN, Islam, where they're not going to be as, I would guess, transparent? They're going to attack you and not listen to you. Have, like, what's that like? Explain that experience.
Yeah. Well, it's never really fun to talk to someone who doesn't want to listen. Or to try to talk over somebody who's just repeating anti-Muslim or Islamophobic rhetoric back at you. But we do it frequently because you never know when you're going to reach the right person, you know, when you're going to reach the eyes and ears and hearts and minds of somebody who may be positively influenced by hearing from you and maybe take up on a better understanding of what it means to be Muslim in America. So it is challenging, but thankfully there's also a lot of good media outlets out there that are willing to give a voice and be objective and allow people to speak to what is really true about who they are and what their community is all about.
Yeah, I can't imagine going on a live TV show where, like, it's clear you're just doing hot takes. Like, there's no deep discussion.
Yeah. They're
just yelling at you, talking over you to make it the segment more popular.
Right, exactly.
Like, there's no interest, I should say, in, like, the truth, both sides, and making it better.
Right.
It's just you're hot taking it. That would just see no fun in that. But you're right, if you can reach one person, it's all worth it.
You never know. You never know. And you've got to allow opportunities for people to hear what you have to say. Otherwise, they only hear one side. So that's kind of our approach to things, is we never want it to just be one-sided. We want to try to balance things out as much as possible.
Absolutely. Well, we were talking about the travel ban. Mm-hmm. One of the things, I think, because it's been so long since 9/11, we forget about, like, if you're Muslim in an airport, those difficulties being singled out. Can you just talk about that?
Yeah, it can be very challenging. I mean, it can range from no problems at all. I've luckily not faced a lot of travel problems personally. However, my father, who's originally from Iran, before he got his citizenship about 10 years ago or so, he faced challenges every time we traveled. You know, he would be stuck in airport security for an extra 15 or 20 minutes compared to myself. The moment he became a citizen, that changed. So there's sometimes not a whole lot of explanation as to why people are given a hard time. We even had a guy back in 2012, Sadiq Long, and he was originally from McAllister, Oklahoma, African-American, born and raised in Oklahoma, joined the Navy, traveled the world, and fell in love with the Turkish culture, and decided to go live over there after he left the services, and he decided to become Muslim. You know, got to know the people, got to know the faith, and he decided he wanted to live overseas, you know, just kind of travel the world. And he lived in UAE and settled down in Qatar, where he was an English translator and a teacher of English for second language. And it was in 2012, he got a call from his mother that she was diagnosed with congestive heart failure. And of course, I mean, she just wants to see her son. It had been more than a decade that he hadn't been back to Oklahoma. So we booked a ticket. And he was actually denied the ability to leave Qatar and travel to the United States and told that you would have to contact your embassy. Well, he contacted his embassy, contacted Governor Fallon, contacted several congressmen from Oklahoma, got no response, contacted other organizations, and didn't really get a response until someone told him to contact CARE. And he did contact us. And after all the research and investigation we did, we found that there was no legitimate reason for him to not travel back to the United States. And so we had to go through all the hoops. So eventually we made it all the way to Secretary of State, at that time Hillary Clinton. And we were given permission by her office that he could travel for 2 weeks without explanation, just that between this date and that date, he could travel back into the U.S. He did. He still faced a lot of scrutiny coming in. You know, he was pulled into a separate room and given several hours worth of questioning and things of that nature. But he finally made it back to Oklahoma on a few days before Thanksgiving, because it was the same night my oldest son was born. And I was actually in the hospital with my wife and got the call that he had arrived late at night in Oklahoma City, Will Rogers Airport. But it had taken more than 6 months and the work of many attorneys and having to go all the way to almost one of the highest offices of our country to get permission for him just to travel back to his own country, of which he is still a citizen. And that's not where the story ends.
While he was here in Oklahoma, he was actually harassed by the FBI, held at gunpoint, and told that they want to ask him questions. That's a whole nother story, which we may not have time for today. But when he wanted to leave the U.S. and go back to Qatar, I went with him twice to Will Rogers Airport, and they would not let him fly. In fact, on the second occasion, we were escorted out of Will Rogers Airport by security guards and an FBI agent and told that you would not be allowed to fly out of the U.S. It's illogical, and it didn't make sense. They didn't want him to fly in the U.S. in the first place, and now they won't let him leave. And the only way he could make it back to Qatar, where his wife and daughter was, and where his job was waiting for him, and he had run through his savings trying to do all this stuff, was he had to travel by bus to Mexico City, from there fly to Brazil, from Brazil to Argentina so he could avoid U.S. airspace, and from Argentina fly to Istanbul, and from Istanbul to Qatar. So I have just given you a very long but serious example of one person, and there are many stories, and you can just search them on Google, and you'll find stories of Muslims who have faced challenges in regards to the no-fly list. This was one man from Oklahoma who was a U.S. citizen, has never been charged with a crime, and was treated this way. So that's the reality. I gave you two extremes. The extreme of having no problems flying, the extreme of being on the no-fly list. And there's everything in between, unfortunately.
Maybe they don't mess with you because they know you work here and you know how to back yourself up.
Oh, perhaps. I mean, we do have an attorney on staff that will be there to help me at any point. But I don't know. I've been blessed and haven't had any challenges in those regards. But my own family has, you know. And it's just really sad to see that what they call these random security checks don't seem to be so random. They seem to target certain groups of people more than others.
Why? So this, if you had to say 10 people of Islam, how many do you think have trouble at airports out of 10?
That's a good question. I would say 3 to 5. So anywhere from 30 to 50%. And there's a lot of factors that go into it. I mean, are they citizens? Are they green card holders? Are they visa holders? You know, there are many factors that will go into it, but I would say anywhere between 30 to 50%, but even 1 out of 10 would be too many, you know?
Absolutely. Like, it's just ridiculous. So yeah. You said you have an attorney on staff.
Yes.
How is CARA funded?
We're actually entirely funded by donations. We don't even actually receive grants at this time. All our funding...
Why don't you receive grants? Sorry to cut you off.
Oh.
But that's just crazy to me.
It's not that we don't want to receive grants. So if there's people out there that, you know, want to give us a grant, we'll take it. It's just about organizational capacity. So we're a young organization still, relatively speaking. We're also only a limited number of staff, and we serve the entire state. And we serve... we have 3 full-time staff members that serve 40,000 people in the state. So there's just not a lot of time to write grants. It takes a lot of time and effort to do that. And there are people who spend their entire careers, you know, doing grant writing. So all of our funding right now comes from individual donations. We have a budget that's growing year after year because a few years ago we realized we need an attorney on staff. If we're gonna be a civil rights organization that really takes on the challenges of today, and in future challenges, and thank God we did. In 2014, we hired our full-time staff attorney. She's now the director of our civil rights department. And I'm glad we hired her in 2014 because we've seen a ton of challenges in the years since. And now we have a full-time government affairs director that focuses on the issues I mentioned earlier, education, engagement, advocacy, you know. Unfortunately, in a state like Oklahoma, a government affairs director is now a necessity. You know, when you've got pieces of legislation that are proposed or attempted to push through to pass in the House or Senate that are against the Muslim community, and you've got politicians and senators or representatives are attacking the Muslim community, you've got to have somebody who's at the Capitol, who's got their ear to the ground on those issues and knows what's going on and is there to defend the Muslim community from all this negative stuff happening.
Absolutely. Well, we were supposed to do this at the beginning, but I kind of got off track on
sure.
the questions. Can you just talk about your background?
Yeah.
What you did before you were in CARA, before we get out of here?
Yeah, sure. So I actually spent 3 years working at the Department of Human Services for the state of Oklahoma before I worked for CARA, which is really cool because I got to work with people who were really in need, and I got to administer programs like the SNAP or more commonly known as food stamp program, Sooner Care or Medicaid, and then daycare assistance. And later in my career over there, I worked in long-term care, so we help people with in-home health care, people with elderly people, people with disabilities. It was a really great experience. I enjoyed working with people one-on-one, with families, and trying to help them improve the quality of their life in the state of Oklahoma. And it really gave me a great insight into some of the challenges that we face here in our state. When you've got numbers like 600,000 or 700,000 people in our state, which is close, nearing one-fourth of our state's population, who are using assistance, government assistance, that's concerning, you know. So it gave me a lot of insight into programs that help people out. Actually here, it enhanced the work I do now with CARE, because when people come and they may face some of these challenges, I can refer them to organizations that can help them. So I work with Department of Human Services. I got my bachelor's in sociology from the University of Central Oklahoma.
I got the same.
All right.
Sociology.
University. I knew there was some connection there, you know. So I lived in Edmond, graduated from Edmond Santa Fe High School. Before that, my family is originally from Kansas, so we kind of moved south of the border, and we've been in Oklahoma since the late 90s. My father works for Langston University, my mother works for Mercy Hospitals, and we just love Oklahoma. It's a great place. A lot of people ask me that question, like, why would you live in Oklahoma? You know, there's all these racists and bigots, and, you know, you got your John Bennett guy, and he's trying to cut Islam out of the state as if it's a cancer and all this kind of crazy stuff. Like, yeah, but you don't know the people. You know, and I think that's the important distinction to make, is that the people of Oklahoma are what make it great. There may be these loudmouths that are racist or bigoted that make things hard and present challenges for living in a place like Oklahoma, but I think it's the people, and it's also the perhaps slower pace of life, if that makes sense, that we're not always rushing from one place to the other. I've visited D.C. several times since I started working for CARE, and people are just always in a rush, you know, going from one place to the other. You get on the metro, and I'm from Oklahoma. I want to spark a conversation with someone. Everyone's got headphones in, you know. They only want to look at you in the eye. You know, they just want to mind their own business. But I think here in Oklahoma, we want to sit down. We want to have these conversations. We want to get to know one another. And to me, that's really what makes it worth, you know, all the challenges we go through, is it just feels like home.
Absolutely. Anything else, any positive story you want to talk about before we get out of here?
Oh man, there's a lot of positive stories I could share, but
just go.
Yeah, well, you know, I think one of the things that bothers me so much these days is that the vast majority of media coverage is in relation to negative things, either negative things such as acts of terrorism committed by extremists who really don't even fit the definition of what it means to follow the Islamic faith, or it's in response to hate crimes and hateful rhetoric. But Muslims have contributed vastly to the state of Oklahoma. I mean, we have, you know, in addition to our community service initiatives, we have donated to all the different things. I mean, back in 2013 when the tornado struck Moore, we collected tons of donations. And we took it to the American Red Cross. We filled a U-Haul van, a big 17-footer U-Haul van and a minivan full of water and hygiene items. And we took it down to the American Red Cross and we gave it to people who were in need. We've got now for the last 2 years, about a year and a half, we have the first ever Muslim-run food pantry at the Islamic Society of Greater Oklahoma City that services hundreds and hundreds of families in need every month. So Muslims collecting items and working in partnership with the Regional Food Bank of Oklahoma just to feed people, you know, provide food items. We have a free clinic called ICNA Relief Shifa Clinic that's open every week and serves about 20 to 40 people who don't have health coverage every week in the state of Oklahoma. I mean, there are just numerous things. I could probably talk to you all day about that, but I think the number one thing that I would want people to walk away with is to know that Muslims contribute to society. We are here to, I mean, do the basic things that everyone else wants to do, which is to live our life, to have a good quality of life for us and our families. But I think our faith compels us to want to give back. So charity is a huge part of our faith. It's one of the major aspects of what it means to be Muslim. And charity is not always understood as in giving money. That is one part of charity, but it means to give back to your community in in any way possible. And I'll leave you with one example. During our month of Ramadan, which is our holiest month of the year, and it moves, and a lot of people don't get that because of the lunar calendar that we follow, so it moves back every year. So it started about end of May this year and went through end of June. So those are some hot days, long days, 15, 16 hours, hot temperatures, we're fasting, no food or drink from sunup to sundown. A group of Muslim women, they call themselves Oklahoma Muslim Women for Humanity, they got together and they partnered with the Homeless Alliance of Oklahoma, and every day for the month of Ramadan, they raised the funds and they served 300 or 400 meals to homeless people, all while they're fasting. And so I think that's one of the greatest examples of the love that Muslims have for the state and how our faith really compels us to give back in any way possible, that that any group of people or any individual can go without food or drink and take their money and their time and sacrifice and go feed others, I think says a lot about who we really are as people.
That's what the positive truth is about. If you ever doing these things, email us. We'll talk about it on one of the Monday, Wednesday episodes.
All right.
Give you a shout out. That's what we try to do on the Monday, Wednesday episodes. Adam, it was great.
Thank you.
Sorry, Tim.
It's been a pleasure. Perhaps we'll have to do this again sometime.
You have an event, let us know.
Absolutely.
We'll come talk to you about it. Till then, stay positive. We're out.